Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Kleinman, who's a professor of public policy at UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches a course on methods of policy analysis and on drug abuse and crime control policy. He's the author of Marijuana Costs of Abuse, Costs of Control, Against Excess Drug Policy for Results, When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and Drugs and Drug Policy, and Marijuana Legalization. He edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin, and he also worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Kleinman.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be on.
And the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman seems to have brought back an awareness, at least in the press, of a heroin addiction that's loose in the land. Some headlines are saying heroin use is up 79%. What do your statistics tell you?
I don't know where the 79% number comes from. You'd have to say up from when and among whom. You'd have to say whether you're talking about the number of users, the number of addicts, the volume consumed, all different numbers. What's been happening, and this is a long process, price of heroin's been falling steadily for 30 years now and is now at something like a tenth of the level it was when I first got interested in this topic. So one thing that's happened is that heroin on the street has gotten purer. That means that people are consuming more just on a daily basis. It also means that it's now economically possible to snort it rather than injecting it. And so the needle barrier is lower than it was for heroin. Other thing that's been happening is that the explosion in the non-medical use of prescription opiate painkillers, particularly hydrocodone and oxycodone, which seems to have started around 1994, 95. Initiation to those drugs is up almost tenfold over that period. And so we've now got about as many people starting those every year as start cannabis every year. Those are substitutes for heroin, but they're more expensive.
And
so one of the dynamics that's happening is that people are getting, so are starting on the pills, which seems safer. You're not, you know, buying them from a grubby street dealer, and you're getting a pill in a pharmaceutical bottle that you don't have to inject. But when people get strung out, they may trade down to the cheaper heroin because the heroin costs about a quarter as much on a per milligram basis. Or they may switch from swallowing to either snorting or injecting, which both of which are easier with powdered heroin than with a pill. So that's the pattern I'm seeing. And heroin's still not very large on the radar screen, but it's clearly what's coming up as cocaine is going down.
And what is this? Apparently, Philip Seymour Hoffman was found with 50 bags of heroin. Some was heroin. A lot of it was brand named Ace of Spades, Ace of Hearts. But apparently, according to preliminary reports, some of it was laced with fentanyl. And apparently that is the new high, at least in that part of New York where he was found dead.
Fentanyl has always looked as if it might be the heroin replacement. It's a synthetic, relatively easy to produce, doesn't have to be imported. The problem with fentanyl that's kept it from ever getting much of a market up till now is dosage control, because you're dealing with very, very small amounts. The risk of overdose is greater. And I haven't seen the toxicology reports on Hoffman, so I'm not sure what he actually died of. I don't know whether he had fentanyl on board. But that's what's been keeping fentanyl from taking off. Now, if you say that it has finally taken off in New York, I'm not very surprised. But its presence on the street has been there. It's been there for a while and has, at least so far, yet to gain much market share.
But when you say it's easier to produce and it can be done here in the United States, you're talking about illegal production?
Yeah. It's not a bathtub chemical the way methamphetamine is. It's complicated chemistry, but you don't need a field full of poppies. You need a chem lab.
I see. But it's very potent and therefore difficult to regulate the amounts. And apparently, at least the reports that are coming in now seem to indicate that fentanyl was in the dose that Hoffman...
There's a specific chemical called fentanyl, and then there's a whole class of fentanyls, some of which are extraordinarily potent. Some down to the microgram level. So I'd want to see what the actual doc said. Fentanyl's somewhat more potent than heroin. but some of the related chemicals are hundreds of times as potent.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Kleiman, who's a professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches courses on methods of policy analysis on drug abuse and crime control policy, and is the author of a number of books, including When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and Drugs and Drug Policy and Marijuana Legalization. He edits the Drug Policy Analysis Bulletin and has also worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. So when drug uses go up and down, and you've discussed how some are going up and some are going down and some are getting cheaper and some are getting more expensive, what drives these fads? I mean, is it like fashion? Is there any explanation for that?
If I knew what drove fashion, I'd be designing women's clothing rather than doing policy analysis.
Right.
The basic mechanism was laid out by David Musto in a book called The American Disease about 40 years ago. A new drug comes on the market, new to some particular user group. Somebody likes it, enjoys it, says to his friends, hey, I've found this wonderful thing. They try it, they enjoy it, they say to their friends, hey, we've got this wonderful thing. And it's fashionable. It's the cutting edge thing to do. Doing it shows you're sophisticated and wealthy. And it snowballs. And so you get literally exponential growth. That is to say, growth that's proportional to the size of the current user group. That goes on for a while, and then two things happen. The pool of susceptibles is depleted. Eventually, everybody who wants to try it has already tried it. And some of the people who tried it and liked it a while ago have now been using it for a while and suddenly aren't enjoying it. They've developed substance abuse disorder. So a new heroin user may very well recruit another new heroin user. Somebody who's been addicted to heroin for 5 years and ruin anybody. He's a standing bad advertisement. And so, and frequently the price falls and the social status falls. And so in 1977, the typical cocaine user was a hedge fund manager and in the public mind. And by 10 years later, the typical cocaine user was a $5 prostitute. Well, oddly enough, I'm not sure it represented sound moral judgment. A lot of people prefer to think of themselves as hedge fund managers. And so as the social status of the drug fell, it got to be less popular among the people who want to be fashionable. So that's the standard epidemic cycle. We're now on the downslope of the cocaine epidemic. We've been on the downslope of the 1960s heroin epidemic ever since. And whether this is the beginning of an uptick or not, ask me 2 years from now.
What I find extraordinary about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death, and obviously we don't know anything about his mental state, but he did have a young family, a son and two daughters, and I'm wondering, what is it about this drug that would make you, in effect, so selfish that you would not think about those that you're leaving behind? Is it that seductive?
Well, not clear to me what he did, right? If he simply got a bad batch, he may not have thought he was doing anything remarkably selfish. I don't know what his level of problem was, though if he had 50 bags, that sounds like he was using pretty steadily. You know, if he died in a drunk driving crash, would he have asked the same question? People get into bad drug habits. That's one of the characteristic risks of using drugs. And it's not less true for alcohol than it is for other drugs.
Well, certainly one's not blaming the victim here. And I was just trying to get into the general and broader question, which I know you've dealt with and a lot of people on drug policy have dealt with, which is we only deal with the after results. We don't deal with the psychological reasons. We never ask the question of why people use drugs, do we?
Oh, no, that's a well-discussed question.
Right.
But here the question is not why he was using, but why his use got out of control to the point where he put his life at risk. Most users of most drugs aren't abusers. The celebrity heroin users who aren't dying today, we haven't heard about. And heroin has what's called a low therapeutic index. That is to say, the ratio between the effective dose and the lethal dose is much smaller than would make a safe drug. And so heroin overdose is a constant risk. There is a public health approach that's been discussed, which is making naloxone, which is an antagonist, widely available. That probably would not have helped in this case. The description I saw was that he'd actually died with a needle in his arm, which suggests that it was really anaphylactic shock rather than than literal overdose. But again, I haven't seen the postmortem.
So this drug that you mentioned, I understand it was called Narcan, which...
Yeah, it's Narcan. It's a drug that competes for the receptor site right. and doesn't actually do anything. And so people can take it as a way of preventing themselves from using heroin or other opiates, because if you take it and then use heroin, nothing happens. But it can also be used to reverse an acute overdose.
And fire departments have it, and it's commonly brought people back that they found in an overdose situation.
Yes.
But the problem would be then if you're a lone heroin user, as apparently Philip Seymour Hoffman was.
Not going to help.
It can't help.
But the other discussion is having it so that it's not just EMTs who have it.
Right. Well,
that the people who are around when somebody's using have it.
Right. Well, that doesn't sound like a bad idea. What's the resistance to that?
Oh, resistance to anything that reduces drug-related harm. Somebody says, well, it'll encourage drug use. The current administration has been supportive, and it's moving as a policy issue now.
Because I recall Mark Kleiman, somewhat slightly different situation, but apparently very much the same drug. You know, the KGB developed a gas, an aerosolite heroin, that was used against the Chechens who took over a theater in Moscow. And that was an operation that was conducted entirely and micromanaged by Vladimir Putin. And they didn't bother to give all of those innocent Russians who were in the theater, who all got gassed along with the Chechen terrorists, Narcan, and they all died. I mean, it was one of the many scandals that's associated with that incident. So, you know, the idea that something exists that could bring people back from the dead and not used is always, I found, very troubling.
So they were using an opiate aerosolized? I hadn't known that.
Yeah, that's how they got everybody unconscious, and then they went through.
What were they using, do you know?
It's some classified KGB-developed drug, but at the time I looked into it, and particularly the fact that Putin himself micromanaged the case and didn't give a damn about the average citizens, just wanted to kill the terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I find troubling, and that these people were just essentially died unnecessarily as collateral damage. Again, you know, the point being that there is something that's available. So it's only available then, this Narcan's only available for what, fire, paramedics?
No, it varies from state to state. So some states are making it available.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, it's not a controlled substance.
I see. So,
I mean, Narcan has no psychoactivity of its own.
Right. So why is it not available then if it's not a controlled substance?
It's a prescription drug, so you need laws that allow the distribution of it.
I see. And you say that there are we're slowly making progress, at least the White House is on the side of making it more available?
Yes. This is not something I've followed closely, but yes, that's something that's moving.
So in terms of where the stuff comes from, going back to street heroin, I guess a lot of it comes from Mexico. But we keep hearing reports about Afghanistan now that we're getting out of after America's longest war, that opium production is at the highest level ever. Is that stuff that you've been following that?
Well, sure. Afghanistan produces all of the opium for the old world. Some of it has gotten into the West Coast, but we're still overwhelmingly dominated by Mexican heroin.
And when you say the old world, that's Europe and Russia?
Yeah, Asia and Europe and Africa all get their opiates from Afghan poppy.
Right. And what about interdiction? I mean, what about buying up the crop? Nothing's ever been able to be accomplished there?
Well, I mean, the problem is that there's not a crop, right? And poppies are easy to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we buy the crop, then the poppy farmers will grow two crops, one for us and one for the dealers.
I see.
I mean, it's been done. It doesn't work. It's a basic economics tells you it won't work.
Well, but there's a certain irony, surely, Mark, where we have fighting a war in Afghanistan. We have it's our longest war. We've been in there for 12 years. And we're also fighting a war on drugs, and somehow...
Well, and we've quite successfully pushed poppy production out of the government-controlled parts of Afghanistan, right? Because we're fighting the war on drugs. What that means is that we've given the Taliban a monopoly on opium for the old world. Right? 27 of the 34 provinces of Afghanistan are poppy-free. The other seven are the ones the bad guys control. So this is a case where the drug war and the war on terror don't go together very well.
So is there then, in the broader sense, an answer here to this ubiquitous drug that is now coming back into popularity? Obviously, interdiction hasn't worked. What are the alternatives?
No. Compared to what? I mean, compared to selling heroin over the counter, I think we have a lot less heroin addiction than we otherwise would have.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an enforcement strategy that substantially reduces heroin? Probably not. At the moment, the biggest advantage we have on the prevention side is the word heroin. A lot of people don't have a problem thinking of themselves as oxycodone users, but really don't want to think of themselves as heroin users. And what you worry about is over time people forget. So, you know, this case may help serve the prevention function.
Well,
there's no consolation to Mr. Hoffman's family.
Well, just in closing then, Mark Lyman, I know we've discussed this before, but it comes back to this idea of, legalization, which is often put up as an alternative to the current drug policy, of course, creates a tremendous backlash. And it may well be a question of semantics. What about the notion of medicalization of the problem? If you had... as they've done in some countries, medical outpatient facilities for addicts to go to, where they get clean drugs administered under clinical conditions, is that a viable alternative?
It's a perfectly reasonable alternative in reasonably well-governed cities. I don't want to think about the security you'd need for your heroin distribution facility in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And it's for a very limited number of really socially problematic and pretty hopeless addicts. It's not what the addicts want. They want to use heroin at home with their friends. So the people who come into the program are the people who are really at the edge. And, you know, since they're very expensive people, even though it's an expensive program, it saves money. It's not a way to address the larger heroin problem. It's a way to reduce the harms associated with the most extreme forms of addiction. So I'm not opposed to it, but it's not a panacea.
So, in other words, when a celebrity dies, we care about it, but the fact that a bunch of hardcore addicts in Bedford-Stuyvesant shooting up amongst their friends, we don't care about it.
No, I didn't say it at all.
I didn't say anything
remotely resembling that.
Uh-huh. No, I didn't. That's my sense, not yours. But is that...
No, in fact, heroin has always been the most vigorously enforced against drug. Right? I mean, if we only cared about drug abuse among prosperous folks, we'd worry entirely on the enforcement side about prescription drugs.
Right.
No, heroin is still the number one enforcement priority, along with cocaine and meth, all of which now are basically not fashionable drugs.
But we have more of it than ever. So where's
well,
you know. Isn't that
no, we don't have more of it than ever. We certainly aren't at the level we were in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an increase over the last several years from a fairly low level.
Yeah, but you say it's cheaper than it's ever been, right? Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper than it's ever been, which suggests that the bulk level enforcement isn't working very well. That is to say that people who traffic drugs have become more efficient in their operations, not surprising. I think there's probably not much we can do on the enforcement side to change things.
Well, Mark, I guess this is a depressing subject, and we're not ending on an optimistic note, and I guess there's no way to, right?
Well, look, the optimistic note is that most people aren't at risk of heroin because they never touch a drug called heroin, and we should hang on to that.
Well, Mark Lyman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Lyman, who's a professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches courses on methods of policy analysis and on drug abuse and crime control policy. And he is the author of When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, and also Drugs and Drug Policy and Marijuana Legalization. He also edits the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis, and he's also worked for the United States Department of Justice as Director of Policy and Management Analysis for the Criminal Division. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Stan Mizrahi and Jose Benavides. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.